Powerful storms that swept through western Wisconsin this weekend left thousands without power and caused significant damage to homes and other buildings. The culprit was some strong straight-line winds measuring up to 80 miles an hour. It tore roofs off buildings and caused large trees to fall, some on power lines, some on houses, some on roads. We'll check in on the damage and the cleanup here on the west side. Good morning, I'm Dean Kallenbach. After our follow-up on the weekend weather damage, we'll shift back to our planned topic for this hour, volunteer firefighting and emergency medical services here in western Wisconsin. For the next few minutes, though, we're joined by WPR's Eau Claire-based reporter Rich Kramer, who's been monitoring the storm damage. And Rich, welcome back to the west side.
Thanks for having me, Dean.
And also with us for the next few minutes is Rod Nordby. He's a member of the Barron City Council. He's also the owner of Nordby Construction, a home builder and remodeler based in Barron. Rod Nordby, thanks for taking a few minutes to be with us this morning. So, Rich, let's start with you. There were a lot of areas affected by the storm throughout the northern half of Wisconsin. Based on what you've been learning, what parts of western Wisconsin took the most damage?
Well, I was focusing mostly on the Barron area, Barron County. I saw some reports on local TV news that there was some bad storms that came through right around 6, 7 p.m. on Friday. So I didn't really have a story assignment or anything. I just wanted to go up there and take a look. So I drove into Barron, and the city was pretty messed up from these winds. A lot of trees down. I mean, pretty much everywhere you looked, you'd see trees. And I saw a lot of trees that had broken off eaves of houses and had gone through parts of roofs. And the other thing that was really startling is when you're coming into Barron on Highway 8 from Highway 53, mm-hmm. you pass by what looks like an old fire station. Now it's the municipal utilities there.
Right.
There's a flagpole that looks like it's been there for quite a long time. The flagpole was bent, and it didn't snap off like a lot of street poles had, but my guess is that the wind resistance from the flag itself actually bent the pole about 10 degrees, wow. And that was pretty impressive to me. But I got a hold of Sheriff Chris Fitzgerald from Barron County on Saturday, and he had said that, or actually on Sunday, he said that the worst hit parts of Barron County were Turtle Lake, Comstock, Elmina, Barron, and Chetek. And it was really interesting, too, with straight-line winds and tornadoes or any storm damage, you can have one yard that looks perfectly fine, mm-hmm. and across the street there's a giant white pine laying on someone's roof. It was really something. And streetlights, metal streetlights, it just snapped in half. I'd never seen that before.
Did Sheriff Fitzgerald have any other observations that were of interest?
Sure. They had to evacuate the fairgrounds because the county fair was going on at the same time. I also saw on social media, I mean, it was definitely not limited to Barron. These storms swept across the whole northern third of the state. The Northern National Weather Service says there were 9 confirmed tornadoes towards the eastern side of Wisconsin, central and eastern Wisconsin, which is really something. Rockfest had to evacuate as well. I mean, there's a lot of pictures on social media of this awful-looking shelf cloud coming in. And I talked to a renter in Barron who, his home, the garage was basically destroyed. His company vehicle was destroyed, and he didn't want to be interviewed for any story, but he just said what really struck him was how everything was like emerald green. He said it was beautiful, but then it hit, and they went to the basement.
Now, there were tornado warnings for parts of our area Friday night. Were tornadoes a factor in this damage?
Not that I know of. I haven't seen any confirmations from National Weather Service. The only tornado confirmations coming from them are in places like Oneida County, Lincoln County, Marathon County. Trempealeau County had one, but it was a EF0, which is it's a tornado, yeah. but it's not especially severe. But Jackson, Wapaka, Outagamie, those sorts of areas. So not that I know of up in the western, northwestern Wisconsin area.
Let's share some thoughts from Sheriff Fitzgerald of Barron County.
Normally when you have a storm, it's, one little area. We were pretty widespread, and to the point where we were putting, I know our highway shop was out clearing roads for us Friday night with their snowplows on. So just to get some of the trees off the road, it was that so many trees down. It's just a devastating storm, but thankfully, we have zero injuries with all these trees down. It's just a miracle that there's zero injuries.
Yeah, that's a big part of the story. Rod Nordby, let's turn to you. Before we speak broadly about your community's response to the storm damage, let me ask you how your home came through the storm. Rod Nordby, are you there? Well, it seems like we've lost Rod Nordby. I apologize for that. Hopefully we can get him back up on the air. But in the meantime, Rich, I drove through Barron County yesterday going north on Highway 25, starting just south of Hillsdale, and I saw a lot of trees on the ground. The unusual part of it is that most of them weren't uprooted, but were instead large, mature trees that were snapped 20 to 30 feet up.
Yeah.
And you have to wonder what it was like to experience that sort of wind as it was happening.
Well, this fellow that I talked to, who, again, didn't want to be recorded for an interview, but he told me that they just started, they were in the basement, they heard the rain, they heard the wind. He said it didn't sound like your stereotypical freight train coming through, but he said they started hearing a lot of loud popping. And that was the sound of all the trees coming down. And those trees, you know, they covered the roads, like the sheriff said. The snowplow thing is something I've never heard before. Usually you see crews out there with chainsaws, then they kind of move the logs to the side. But I'm just picturing them going Mad Max style, just driving right through the middle of the road with the plow down. So it was just so widespread that the sheriff said they had to kind of come at it from a different with a different approach. But the power lines were down. I mean, I had to drive under power lines. I mean, you could tell that the city hadn't gotten, they were still taking care of emergencies, and they couldn't get to the cleanup yet by Saturday afternoon.
Well, I was up there. My brother actually lives in Hillsdale, and my mother lives across the road from him and on the home farm, and a lot of big branches down in the home farm. Part of the roof of the barn was torn off. The silo chute was down, and there was a piece of sheet metal stuck in the ground. We don't know where it's from, but it was stuck so hard you couldn't pull it out with one hand. It was was really down there. So
yeah,
that was pretty neat.
Well, that's another thing. As I was driving on Highway 8 past Barron and heading towards the Turtle Lake, you know, Elmina area, or Turtle Lake area, the barns really got it.
Yeah.
The big metal buildings, there were a few that I saw the roof was ripped off, and it was across the street in someone else's farm field. So it's never good to see that. But you know what impresses me the most is the resilience of the people.
Yeah.
They just put their heads together and made it happen.
Well, one of those people who made his way through that storm is Rod Nordby. We've got him back on the line. Thank you, Rod, for joining us this morning. So, again, let me ask you how your storm came through, or how your home came through the storm.
Well, my home was one of the lucky ones. I just had a big limb off the tree up on my porch. Other than that, a few trees down in the yard. But I'm one of the lucky ones.
Okay, and our connection's not great, Rod. We'll muscle our way through here. You're in the home building business. What does you see as far as building damage that will need to be dealt with?
Well, the calls are coming in, and it seems to be a lot of roof damage, of course, and mostly caused by trees falling on buildings.
Yeah. As you made your way through Barron, what jumped out at you as you assessed the damage?
You know, Barron has a lot of these big white oak trees that are almost as old as the city itself. And we lost a big number of those. And those trees are some of the ones that caused some of the most damage on houses.
Well, because they're so big.
Because they're big.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I noticed that I drove one of the real accents in Barron, and on the east side, there's this big cemetery with huge trees. And all along Highway 8, as you're driving past that cemetery, those big trees along the edge are down, and many of the trees in the cemetery itself. Did you get a chance to get out there, Rod?
Yes, I saw the cemetery, and due to the ground conditions being so wet, a lot of them just pulled out of the ground roots.
Yeah, you got several inches of rain as part of this storm, correct?
You know, I actually wasn't in town. I was up in Hayward for the week.
Okay.
But when I got back on Saturday, it's been a lot of rain pretty much all summer.
Dean, if I could just jump in, I talked to Tyler Gritzmacher, who actually works for Barron County in the Soil Conservation Department, and his house was one that had its eaves broken off by one of these white pines that came, or it was a silver maple in his case, but he said miraculously his roof didn't leak, and that's a good thing, he said, because Saturday morning, he said, it rained harder than he's seen in a long, long time, like really heavy.
Now, all those downed trees caused a number of power outages in the region. Rich Kramer, where do things stand now for getting the power grid back to fully functioning?
So according to Xcel Energy, there were around 25,000 people in western and northwestern Wisconsin that lost power Friday night and or Saturday. As of yesterday afternoon, Xcel said there were 2,000 still remaining without power. That's a large number, but I got a press release over the weekend from Wisconsin Public Service and We Energies over on the eastern side. They had 80,000 without power, and I think the majority of that has been restored, but they're still working. Those companies said they'd have to rebuild their network. There was so much damage.
Rod Norby, what's the power situation in Barron this morning? Any idea?
As of this morning, I talked to our utility manager, and he says everybody should be back in power in the city limits unless they need to call an electrician to have their meter put back on the house.
Right.
All the lines are energized and everybody should have power.
How else is city government responding to the crisis in Barron?
Well, you know, our street department and the electric department have some pretty veteran members on there, and they just know what to do.
Yeah.
And that's the amazing part of this. They just take over and things get done.
Well, as I drove through Barron late yesterday afternoon, the thing that jumped out is I saw a lot of people out. Groups of six or seven neighbors gathered around a pile of branches. There's some newly cut cordwood. That neighbors helping neighbors, kind of a typical response, isn't it, Rod Norby?
Well, as you know, the Barron area community is a strong-knit community and always seems to pull together when events like this happen, as you've seen over the last year. And so, yeah, I saw people that had their own damage helping other people that were in tougher shape than themselves. So, yeah, it all pulls together. And the town this morning looks a whole lot different than it did 2 days ago.
It does.
And, Dean, on Saturday, I noticed there was a crew from Jenny-O that was in people's yards hauling branches. They were actually from Wilmer, Minnesota, and they had come because they were called over to assist in a barn collapse on one of the Jenny-O farms. But because of power outages, they couldn't get to work, so the team leader said, hey, guys, you want to help out? And they rolled up their sleeves, and they were out there.
Yeah, I heard a lot of those good neighbor stories, too, including restaurants offering free meals for folks without power, just people who are so busy cleaning up they couldn't cook. And people loaning out their gas generators to those who are without power. So, Rich Kramer, now that we're back to the work week, what happens next for these folks who weathered the winds?
Well, I imagine you get a hold of your insurance company if you've got... So I'm a new homeowner, and I'll tell you what, I had the sinking feeling in my stomach when I was seeing these roofs with trees busted through them because I had a roof leak, and just that alone, you know, really causes some angst. So I imagine there's a lot of people bringing... just kind of putting their heads down and figuring out what comes next. I imagine there's going to be a lot of insurance adjusters up there.
Rich Kramer, Rod Norby, thanks for joining us to provide an update on the weekend weather damage.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Coming up, we return to our originally planned subject, volunteers who provide emergency medical services and firefighting in western Wisconsin. We'll bring in our guests in a bit, but first, if you have questions or comments about volunteer fire departments and their role in your life, feel free to join us by calling 800-228-5615. That's 800-228-5615. I'm Dean Kallenbach. You're listening to The West Side on the Ideas Network. So before there were established fire departments, there were bucket brigades. Many early communities in the United States required homeowners to have buckets in their houses. When the fire alarm sounded, families would open the doors and throw their bucket out into the street. The buckets were then picked up by the men running by on the way to put out the fire. Well, nowadays, some things are different. In place of the buckets, we now have fire trucks with hoses, and firefighting itself can be a career. But some things haven't changed. Volunteer firefighters are still around today. In fact, more than 90% of fire stations in Wisconsin are either completely or mostly volunteer. Why do volunteer firefighters put their lives on the line for little or no pay or compensation? And how did they get into firefighting? And how did they learn the skills required to stop fires and save lives? We explore those topics for the remainder of the hour today on the West Side. We're talking about volunteer firefighting. And our guests are John Anderson, who has been a volunteer firefighter with the Chippewa Fire District for more than 40 years. Deputy Chief Anderson, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Mark Schwartz is a fire EMS educator and trainer at Chippewa Valley Technical College and an ambulance driver in Bloomer as well. Mark Schwartz, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. No problem.
And Darren Vick is the fire chief at the Spooner Fire Department. Darren Vick joins us by phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
So are you a volunteer firefighter? Are you looking to become one? Or maybe you just have questions about what the job entails. Join the conversation by calling 800-228-5615. That's 800-228-5615. So motivation is one of the big questions that pops to my mind when it comes to volunteering to serve as a firefighter or first responder. John Anderson, you've been with your district for 42 years. What got you started?
Well, basically, I was a college student at UW-Eau Claire working on my master's degree, and an ad appeared in the paper, the Chippewa Herald at the time, that the Chippewa Fire District was being formed. I did it for several reasons. One, to help the community, the neighbor helping neighbor concept. Secondly, I'd been interested in firefighting for many years. My uncle was a firefighter for the city of Marshfield. I also felt that I had some time to devote to the community, and I thought this was probably the most effective way to do it.
And before we move on, John Anderson, can you describe the area that the Chippewa Fire District serves?
Sure. The easiest way to describe it is we border the northern part of the city of Eau Claire and the southern border of the city of Chippewa Falls. The space between Chippewa Falls and Eau Claire is served by the Chippewa Fire District as a, if you will, another reference point. Township Fire Department serves the city, the area south of the city of Eau Claire, and the Altoona Fire Department serves the city east of Eau Claire. So that gives you kind of a geographic boundary.
Good. Darren Vick, you're now the chief of the Spooner Fire District. What made you decide to go into volunteer firefighting, and how did your volunteering progress into your current role as chief?
Well, for me, it started out my grandfather was a firefighter, and I remember that as a kid. And, growing up all through the years, that was something I was thinking I would like to do. And then I ended up, moving. I originally came from South Dakota, of which I was on a department out there, and then made my way over to Wisconsin and just got involved here. And I served as a volunteer chief for quite a few years, about 10 years. And then the district was actually looking at that time to hire on somebody full-time. We just knew with the things that are required today, we couldn't do it at a volunteer level anymore. And originally, I wasn't part of that plan. I was the chief, and we were thinking we'd have another person in that role. But as the board discussed things and talked about things, they decided they thought this should be the full-time position. So that's kind of how it all evolved for me.
Very good. Mark Schwartz, though you're now a trainer and educator at Chippewa Valley Technical College, you also started as a volunteer. Talk us through your inspiration to get into emergency medical services and firefighting.
Sure. I'm currently still a volunteer firefighter with Bloomer Fire Department, and I'm the ambulance chief in Bloomer as well. And I honestly was one of the people who left high school, and I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I worked construction, different jobs here and there. My mom was a nurse, so I was always interested in the medical side of things. And then I knew our fire department was always looking for people, so I got on the volunteer fire department, became an emergency medical responder just about the same time, and I just really, really enjoyed doing it. And the longer I did it, the more I realized I probably would like to do this as a career. So I went to college at CVTC, graduated the fire medic program, got a full-time job as a firefighter paramedic with the city of Chippewa Falls. And from there, I went to be a full-time paramedic in Rice Lake. And I've been doing that stuff since then. And then I just recently became the Emergency Services Continuing Education Coordinator at CVTC.
So in your role at CVTC, you're seeing students who want to get into this field. Also, you're seeing some folks who have already committed. Are there any common traits you notice among those students?
I mean, they all want to help. Easy answer is they want to help people. But if you look into it a little bit more, I mean, like a lot of the talk we've already had, a lot of them just have family ties. Grandpa was on the fire department. You know, mom was a nurse, or they have aunts and uncles. I have family members on my fire department in Bloomer. So a lot of it is just they want to be involved in something. And then it's also, it's a different type of volunteering. You know, we're not handing flyers out for stuff. We're, you know, responding to emergencies. Yeah. So everybody sees fire and ambulance and police cars sitting somewhere and they want to know what's going on.
Yeah.
So being part of it allows you to know what's going on.
So Darren, Vic, how do you find people you need to staff your department?
Well, I tell you, that's kind of the hard part for us today. When I started originally, we always had a waiting list, you know, of people that wanted to get involved, and we no longer have that. I used to hear about it and thought, well, that won't happen up here, but it has. And, you know, I think one of the challenges that we're dealing with today is, you know, technology is good in a lot of ways, the new technology we have, and it's also bad. I remember growing up as a kid, you know, I went to the gas station and I had to pay for my gas and I ran into people there. I went to the bank and, you know, saw people there, and I'd have to run an errand to the, you know, to a store for my mom, and I'd see people, and I really understood what community was about. So I, you know, knew when it came to doing, returning back that favor, I did. You know, today it's really hard. It just seems like a lot of the younger people that we talk to trying to get them involved, I think we're missing a little bit of what community is about. You know, they do their banking online, they do their shopping online. You know, they don't pay for their gas. They may not even go into the store. They pay for it at the pump. So I think that's the tricky part that we're at least experiencing right now, is we approach them and we're having a little trouble, but we're, you know, we do our best to try and get the word out and, you know, let them know we're always looking for help on the fire department.
Our topic here on the West Side is the emergency medical services and volunteer firefighting. You're welcome to join the conversation at 800-228-5615. There's a rule change coming up in October to the Wisconsin State Fire Department Safety and Health Code that holds public firefighters to a higher training standard. It bars new firefighters from participating in structure fires unless they've met that minimum training requirement. John Anderson, have Wisconsin firefighters been undertrained up till now?
Well, I think the training has evolved. When I started back in 78, we took what's called Firemanship 1A and 1B, which was two 30-hour classes, which was 60 hours. That particular component has not changed. You can still take what's called entry level for 60 hours. But most people decide that they're going to go on and become certified firefighter one, and that's approximately 96 hours. They've added a hazardous material awareness component, which I never had back in 78.
Right.
Another particular issue is I don't think people were necessarily under-trained. I think what happened was the training did not, at the time, and even up to the current, take into consideration the changing hazards of fire. One simple example is when I started in 1978, we were dealing with old construction. 2x4s were 2x4s, limited plastics. But since that time, we've evolved to modern construction, which we call lightweight, more plastic components, you know, less dimensional lumber, things like that. And a statistic that I think most people hear but don't really understand, back in 78, if you had an older house, you could take about 15 minutes to get out of the house before the fire became untenable for you. Now we're down from anywhere from 3 to 6 minutes.
Is that because of fumes?
It's because of the plastics that's involving the other components. And Wisconsin being Wisconsin, bless our hearts, it took a long time for training to evolve to the standard that we really need today to make people more aware, and especially firefighters, that the things that we were able to do when I started are no longer possible because of the change in construction. And I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm just saying that's the reality of today's fire service.
We heard Darren Vick of the Spooner Fire Department talk about the difficulty in recruiting candidates. Now, will this extra training that OSHA is requiring affect the ability to fully staff volunteer departments, do you think?
I think what it'll require people to do is plan their time more, arrange their schedules. I also think that, as difficult as this may be, local fire departments, especially volunteers, will probably have to start compensating their members for this training, because in the nuclear family is gone. In my district, most parents work their child care duties. The kids have much more opportunities than my kids had growing up, even, you know, between 80 and 2000. Will it be a burden? Yes, in some part, but I think it's a burden that can be managed with planning on both the fire department's part and the people that are currently firefighters.
Darren Vick, the new standards, as I mentioned, were created by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA. Does the Spooner Department meet those standards now, or will your firefighters need further training?
Well, for us, you know, I think we do meet the requirements, but when they did come out with this SPS 330, the new edition, it kind of made us look back a little bit and say, okay, you know, there's the driver operator that has been added in, and it had been, you know, for us probably 10, 12 years since we had put our department through driver operator training. So when that came about, we kind of said, well, we're going to have to step up now and get that training done. And I think the problem comes, you know, John makes a very good point. You know, it's a challenge, and that's really the hard part for volunteer departments. How do we find all these people that have so many activities going? How do we say to them, by the way, you know, not only do you, when you come on the department, we got to have the firefighter training, but you also got to have driver operator training, and there's an officer training now that the new standard, really, this is the toughest part, I think, for us, is a standard comes along that says if you want to be an officer on the department, you can't really obtain, you know, you can't take that role until you have the officer training completed. Well, that's really tricky because not everybody on the department, you know, is going to have time to get that officer training in. But, you know, like anything, we have to work at it. We got to do our best to try and achieve it. But I do have some thoughts on the training, which we'll get to later. But yeah, we found a few gaps in our department that we're trying to work on, and it's a challenge.
Mark Schwartz, will CVTC be providing the training needed to bring these firefighters up to these OSHA standards?
Yeah, just like any other technical college, all the technical colleges in the state are tasked with fire training. So like the driver operator class, that was a class that, you know, we would offer once in a while when a department requests it. But now that it's a requirement to operate those type of vehicles, instead of getting, you know, a couple calls a year for it, I'm getting a couple calls a month for this class. Mm-hmm. And with over 50 fire departments in CVTC's training district, it's not only a challenge for them, but it's a challenge for us because we only have so many instructors to hold all these classes. So it's a challenge on both ends.
So do you think this rule update might make it harder for recruitment and retention of volunteer firefighters?
I guess that would be depend on the way it's approached. The driver operator class is a 30-hour class. You don't have to have it to be a firefighter. You have to have it to operate a fire truck with a pump. So a brand new person right out of the gate might not even need to take the class. You know, they could probably wait a year or 2 years or 3 years until they'd even be comfortable operating a truck like that with all the components and stuff that go with it. So depending on the way it's approached. But I like to, you know, tell everyone these classes are only a one-time deal. You only have to fit it into your schedule once. It's not like you have to do this every year. So that sometimes is a little bit of a light at the end of the tunnel.
So John Anderson, you've been doing this since, I think you mentioned, 78. How did you learn to balance the responsibility of volunteer firefighting with the rest of your life?
Well, It was, I'm not going to tell you it was easy. First of all, I had a very supportive spouse. And it when I first started, I was able to have my neighbors come over and stay with my kids. My family accepted from time to time I would miss a birthday party, some family event. Ironically, the one event I would never miss is my wedding anniversary. But it's the nature of the game. I left my family on Christmas Day more than once, Thanksgiving. Oh, sure. It comes with the territory, but our department and many departments are fortunate because, for example, during deer hunting season, we would know who would be gone, but the folks that were out deer hunting would be around for Christmas and things like that. So we tried to work that way. It's actually easier the longer you're on the department because you've completed your initial training. Things that are come up, it's status quo. Our department has a very good in-house training program. But there's still sacrifices people are going to have to make. And, of course, that's true of the career fire service also, because if you're scheduled Christmas Day and New Year's Day, that goes with the job. So you have to accept some things. But I'll tell you, you have to have a supportive family. If they don't support you, then you have problems.
Darren, Vic, we've established that 90% of fire departments in Wisconsin are either entirely or mostly staffed by volunteers. How prepared are volunteer firefighters like those in your department at Spooner compared to career full-time firefighters?
Well, you know, there's really kind of a two-tier, you know, department, I think, in my eyes, in the state of Wisconsin. And I think you've got your career firefighters, and some of the tasks and duties that they do are a little different than, you know, some of the rural, smaller departments. And for me, you know, up in my area here, we have a good crew. I think they're very prepared and ready to handle the calls. But again, we kind of know what to expect in our area. You know, we usually get kind of the same types of calls. We've got our structure fires. We've got our, you know, our car accidents that we have on the highway. We have our you know, recreational people that come up and end up getting in trouble, you know, snowmobiling or four-wheeling, and our grass fires, the wildland time. So for us, I think we're very prepared, and, you know, it's a little bit different than the full-time because the full-time, they have kind of their own world of issues that they deal with, and so they're kind of really tuned into theirs. Now, if you said, "Hey, we want to bring your group into a big city and tackle some things," we probably would be a little bit out of our element because we don't deal with standpipes, we don't deal with 3-4 story buildings, and but likewise, you know, they come up here. Some of them have trouble saying, "Gee, what's the deal with this water shuttling thing?" Where we're doing it every time we go on a call. So there's features that are different about departments, and I think it's there's kind of a almost a different level of them. Now, I think they all are, you know, they all need to have their training, and they all do take their training, but it seems like we use a lot of different areas of firefighting. We have a little difference that way.
We're talking about volunteer firefighters. You're welcome to join our conversation at 800-228-5615, 800-228-5615. Our guests are Darren Vick of the Spooner Fire District, John Anderson of the Chippewa Fire District, and Mark Schwartz of the Bloomer Fire District. He's also a fire EMS educator at Chippewa Valley Technical College, and we'll be back with them in a bit. But coming up after the break, we hear from Western Wisconsin's most famous volunteer firefighter, Michael Perry. I'm Dean Kallenbach, and you're listening to The West Side on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Western Wisconsin's most famous volunteer firefighter is Michael Perry. He shared his experiences on the New Auburn Fire Department, New Auburn Area Fire Department, in his best-selling book, Population 485, Meeting Your Neighbors One Siren at a Time. The book made New Auburn a tourist destination for some and has inspired a musical play by the same name. His success as an author and a performer, including his role as the host of Tent Show Radio, heard every Saturday night here on this station, has kept him from being an active firefighter for a few years, but he does continue to serve as a first responder. And I asked him late last week, what motivated him to become a volunteer firefighter in the first place?
There's a serious answer and a funny answer, and they're both true.
Okay.
The serious answer is when I moved back to my hometown of New Auburn in 1995, I'd been away for 12 years, and I had my nursing license, and I was also a licensed EMT intermediate, taking calls down in Eau Claire. So in a way, it was natural because I already had some EMS background, and I was able to pick up some shifts on the volunteer ambulance service in Chautauqua, Wisconsin. But New Auburn was where I was living back in my hometown, and the fire department was literally across the alley from my house. So, and they were looking for folks. So I joined up there and got my firefighter training and certifications. But the reasons was, first of all, the kind of jokey one is that when I moved back, my two brothers and my mom were already on the fire department. So I always joke that it was
family affair.
Yeah, man, it was a peer pressure situation. And the other one that actually has been more lasting is that I'm pretty much a loner. I'm a writer mostly and spend my time alone in a room. And I've always been a loner. I like to meet people and converse, but mostly given a choice, I like to be alone. And as a result, I'm not a real good joiner. When I moved back to New Auburn, I didn't join any of the local churches. I don't drink, so I didn't go to the taverns. I joke about not playing softball and not bowling and that I can't polka. It's all true. And so the fire department became this natural place where I could do two things. I could join and make a connection with the community, the people in the place, but I could also volunteer in a way that was comfortable and within my skill sets. Yeah, I've never been a real good cheerleader, but I was a decent EMT, and I could learn how to fight fires and show up when there was trouble. And, yeah, I can't ever give a short answer.
That's all right. If we got time. Your essays and books have dealt with a wide variety of topics depicting rural life. Beyond the obvious, with Population 485, what other ways has firefighting and first responding impacted your writing and your performing career?
Well, two things. A, just the human connection. You know, I've been writing a lot and even performing a lot about the idea of vulnerability and what it feels like when we're vulnerable. And it's not very comfortable. And sometimes it's a result of us messing up, or maybe that vulnerability comes through illness or accident. And one thing that EMS and fire do is they always keep you refreshed with the idea that none of this is stable. It can all be taken away in a heartbeat. And I think especially back when I was doing more of it, I love driving fire trucks and shiny ambulances with flashing lights and sirens. But the most lasting impressions are those quiet moments when a real roughneck neighbor of mine is maybe kneeling in a ditch and gently helping someone who's been injured and is frightened. And I think that's probably one of the things that just keeps me going, is that direct line to our vulnerability.
Did it ever go the other way, where your writing career affected your work in the fire department?
No. As a matter of fact, when I was writing specifically about firefighting, I had told my chief ahead of time that I was writing the book, but I asked him not to tell anybody. And then before it was published, I announced it in the fire meeting and let people sit down with me and see the galleys and make changes if they. And honestly, nobody asked for any changes. And I did, you know, I changed names and things like that. But I did find out that one of my favorite guys, who I have a lot of stories about him, a friend of mine, Bob, the One-Eyed Beagle, still see him.
Yeah.
He started coming up with a lot of extra stories after he found out I was writing a book. And I just said, man, it's okay. The book's over. And besides, the quality of your material is deteriorating.
Had to have something for the sequel, yeah. Right?
And as far as my writing, nursing was had a huge effect on my writing. I learned, I went to a nursing school, have a bachelor's degree in nursing, not writing. And we were taught human assessment and how to not just get tunnel vision on the abdominal pain. And one of the things they teach you in firefighting, don't get tunnel vision. Don't just focus on the fire coming out the window. Look at the structure. Look at the wind. Look at all the other things that are going on that are just as critical. And as a writer, you use those lessons, in that you don't just write about the tractor pull. You look at the people at the tractor pull. You look at why attendance might be up or down. What does that say about wider society? All these things. So I think it affects me that way.
And your writing is based on those powers of observation. So within that context, are there common traits that you've noticed about individuals who volunteer to perform emergency services?
Yes and no. I know the easy answer is to say the common trait is that they're all folks are into volunteering and giving of their time. And that's true. That's no matter your reason for showing up when the pager goes off, the fact remains you're showing up. And I remember early on when I was writing, I would get a little grumpy about some folks I thought maybe were just showing up because of the gear. And an older firefighter took me aside and said, you know, some of those folks that look like they're just showing up for the gear are also really good at what they do. And that was a good lesson for me. One of the common things is it's just people taking time out of their lives, which is one of the reasons it's harder and harder to find volunteer firefighters and EMTs. I'm a perfect example. My life has gotten to the point where I rarely make calls. I try to keep my training up and be available. But everybody's getting stretched thinner and thinner, and your interests are divided over many, many things anymore. And so anyone who's still showing up has definitely got that dedication.
Well, and you've moved from New Auburn, but you're still part of a volunteer fire district with all that being on the road like you are. What is your motivation for keeping your foot in the door and still being a member?
Well, first, the interesting thing about why I joined, the minute I moved, I joined the local first responder crew, and it was for some of the same reasons as when I went back to New Auburn. I'm not a joiner, and I was moving to an area where I didn't know everybody, and I thought, well, we did this once before. Let's do it again, and you join up. And in this case, it's not so much that I got to know all my neighbors because it's a different sort of arrangement, but I'll never forget going to that first meeting with Emergicare here where I live now and just hearing that language and hearing that syntax and the language of rescue and the terminology and the joking and the fun and the seriousness intertwined. And to this day, one of my favorite things, a lot of times I'm out of town for the meetings, but when I can, I make it because I just love to be in a world that's so different than what I'm doing the rest of the week, and yet I can communicate in that language, and I feel a bond with those folks. We may not be voting the same, whatever, but when I'm on the road and I'm far away, if one of my family members gets hurt, those are the folks who are going to show up and help them, and I never forget that.
Of all his experiences, Perry says the single most meaningful thing he has ever done is serve 12 years beside his neighbors on the New Auburn Area Fire Department. Michael Perry now lives near Fall Creek as an author, humorist, singer-songwriter, intermittent pig farmer, and first responder. We're back with our live guests for the hour. John Anderson, he's a volunteer firefighter with the Chippewa Fire District, also spent 25 years with the state as a fire prevention educator. We also have Mark Schwartz. He is a fire EMS educator and trainer at Chippewa Valley Technical College and also involved with the Bloomer Volunteer Fire Department. And Darren Vick is the chief of the Spooner Fire District. And we're glad to have all those folks here today. And maybe, Darren Vick, I'll start with you as you hear Mike Perry's look back. And again, he's got away with words, obviously. But anything jump out at you as things that seem particularly true for your department?
I think everything that he said was spot on. He is a very good speaker, and you know, he sums it up so well. I do think that this is a great family to be part of, the firefighter family, and we're just out there trying to help the people in our community and help each other. But I would say he's spot on, and everything he said, I agree with.
Darren Vick, as chief of your department in Bloomer, you not only have to fight fires and provide emergency services yourself, but you also have to manage a group of people who are working other jobs for most of their time or doing other things for most of their time. What are the special management challenges to be a chief of a group of volunteers?
Well, I think for me, it's, you know, sometimes you get to pushing a little bit because you just want to make sure that everybody, you know, has the right training and is doing the right things. And sometimes I find that I come across a little bit tough and I have to pull the reins back because when it's a volunteer, you have to be a little bit careful because pretty quick they look at you and say, you know what, I don't need this anymore. And so that's the biggest balance for me is how hard do you push, how much can I get out of them without having them turn around and say, that's it. I'm a volunteer, and I can't give you anymore. I can't do anymore. that's the biggest boundary that I have problems with. Everything else seems to float very well, as Michael Perry had mentioned on here. You know, everybody enjoys coming to this because it's different from their regular day, and they can come in and they can be part and do something different and do something good. It's my job to make sure that I just don't take that too far while I have them, you know, here with me.
John Anderson, you've been with the Chippewa Fire District for more than four decades now. Do you ever see problems with morale or interpersonal conflicts like you would in a normal workplace?
Oh, definitely. The one thing about dealing with volunteer firefighters is everybody has an opinion. And the other thing is nobody is bound to a department by the necessity of receiving a paycheck or whatever compensation you get. So I think people are perhaps more freer to speak out on issues that concern them because most volunteer fire departments, even though we have a traditional quasi-military command structure, the right to express yourself is foremost in a lot of people's minds. And sometimes that can be very difficult. In my case, on my department, our age ranges from high school seniors, 18 years old, up to our oldest member is 82.
Wow. Wow.
And he does the mechanical. So you have a clash in generations somewhat. Because of my age, I kind of look back and go, well, I can be these kids, and I call them all kids, grandfather. And that takes a little getting used to and adjusting on my part. Because people aren't interested in war stories much anymore. They're interested in currently what's going on at the department, what's going on in their own lives, and you have to recognize that.
We've got a couple minutes left. Earlier this year, Representative Trig Prunchinsky of Mondovi, along with several state representatives, co-sponsored a bill that would create three refundable tax credits for volunteer EMS responders. The bill would give volunteer firefighters and those providing emergency medical services a $300 tax credit in their first 5 years and a $600 per year credit for those who volunteered for 5 years or more. Two additional tax credits would add as much as $900 toward the cost of training and equipment. Mark Schwartz, as a trainer as well as a volunteer yourself, how do you think this bill will impact volunteer firefighters?
I think anything's going to help. Being able to, at the end of the year, say, well, you know, I'm going to get some money back for doing this, especially for those people who are not compensated at all. You know, is it going to be the breaking point of, you know, well, I'll stay on because I get this tax credit? It very well might be, and that's going to keep people responding to calls, answering the pager, and getting out and helping the people that need help.
Darren, Vic, do you think this bill is enough to fix some of the structural needs of rural fire stations?
Well, I guess, you know, I've been saying this for a long time now. I'll say it again. I think they need to do a little bit more. And the reason I say that is I think if you take a look at the volunteer base that's across this area, and we're starting to see kind of a crunch coming now with, recruiting and some of the generation not wanting to, you know, get involved. We have to be very careful as volunteers and what they are providing for a service throughout our entire United States. If we lose these volunteers and the service is still needed and is going to be required, it's going to turn everything into more paid positions. And that's the biggest challenge that I think that we have, and people don't think about that. If we have to start paying this 90% of firefighters that are out there, because they don't want to be part of it, that's going to really hit the tax base and hurt a lot of people.
And we'll make that the last word on our topic today. That's Darren Vick. Darren Vick is the chief of the Spooner Fire Department. We also had as our guest today John Anderson of the Chippewa Fire District, Mark Schwartz of Chippewa Valley Technical College, and the Bloomer Fire District. Thank you all for being with us today.
Thank you. Thanks.
Special thanks to author and performer Michael Perry for sharing some of his reflections on being a volunteer firefighter. And thanks to Barron City Council member Rodney Nordby and WPR reporter Rich Kramer for their observations on the damage caused by our weekend storms. Clara Neipert produced this hour. Catherine Thomas was on the phones today. Thanks to Ali Schulze and Kate Spranger for publicity and to John Davis for digital support. Next week, we commemorate the anniversary of the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act by talking about what it's like to live in Western Wisconsin with a disability. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Dean Kallenbach, and this is The West Side on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.